Chapter 13, Taking Risks. To risk is to lose your footing momentarily. To not risk is to lose yourself. Soren Kierkegaard. The year was 1980. I was transitioning from a public sector psychologist to a job at Hewlett-Packard. I was terrified. I knew nothing about business or technology. Surely, they would soon see what a mistake it had been to hire me. Between the time I got my offer letter and my start date, July 5, 1980, I came across a book, Skills for Success, by Adele Sheeley. Like it had been written just for me, it was loaded with strategies to make my transition successful. Fast forward to 2014. I was attending the San Miguel Writers Conference in Mexico. The first night after a gala welcoming session, I was standing in line for wine and cheese. I started a conversation with the woman behind me. I introduced myself, and she said, "Good to meet you, Rick. My name is Adele Sheeley." I completely lost it. I turned into a slobbering, adoring fan meeting a celebrity writer. I told her what her book had meant to me. We talked for an hour. The next day, she was gracious enough to give me an interview. What she told me about risk-taking has informed much of my work since then.
The most dividing way to tell whether people are going to succeed is whether they're able to take risks or not. What it looks like when you take a risk is that you give up all of the negatives of risk-taking, which is saving face, even though you don't think that you can do it, step up to it. There are all kinds of imposter theories, but mostly it's about giving up, feeling that nobody will like you, you don't look good, you're not smart enough, and say, okay, I'm going to take a chance with an idea, with a human being, with an organization. And you start with small risks, and you can then build to bigger risks. But you can never get to big risks unless you start with the small ones. A lot of it has to do with feeling that you're a victim, but mostly feeling that you're what I call the good student, that you wait and you wait and you wait for others to acknowledge you and bring you up to speed, to bring you to the next thing. And actually, nobody sees you when you're being perfectly good. You're invisible. So you have to learn to tell about it in a way that is not bragging, that, you know, isn't tooting your own horn too much, but still allowing the other person to receive the compliment that you want to give them. And then you can say, and here's something that I found that you might like. So in that way, both people win, instead of you turning your boss or turning your client into a teacher who will grade you.
Adele illustrated these ideas with her personal story about how she got her book published against all odds. She took a risk with a New York publisher and got what she wanted.
Applying what I've just said to myself about taking risk, not knowing where you're going, I decided that I would turn my dissertation about the identification of these success skills and see if I couldn't sell it as a book to New York. I didn't know anything about the book business then. And I flew to New York. Oh, I was thinking of flying to New York to interview a publisher who I wanted to very badly to pick up my book. I could not get the publisher's attention. So even though he had written a book in hardback, the book had come out in softback. And I thought, just in a second, here's how I would get his attention. I wrote a check for the difference between the hardback and the softback, telling him this is what I owed him for not having bought it in the first place. And this is why I picked him to be the publisher that I thought would be really good for me. And he, of course, responded immediately, having cashed the check. He responded saying that I could have an appointment with him for 15 minutes from 11:45 to 12:00 in New York the following week. So I flew there, prepared myself for it, but did not prepare myself for his question to me, looking at me, seeing me not thin and svelte, saying to me, taking advantage of it, "Oh, so who would believe you could tell anybody else how to behave well? You don't even follow a diet." And I was appalled, I must say. I stood there thinking, should I poke him in the nose? Should I turn on my heel and walk out? And then a third thought came, use it, baby, use it. So I said, that is the hope that you want people to have. You don't want them to get thin when they read diet books, so they'll never buy another one. You don't want them to be very successful if they buy one book on success. You want a continued one. So what the self-help market is, from a publisher standpoint, is offering the promise. And he said to me, why don't you sit down? And so we began our conversation.
Since Adele introduced me to the relationship between risk-taking and success, I've become more aware of people who jump off the cliff to get what they want. To me, there are two types of risk. One is physical, the kind that can result in serious injury or death. For example, in Chapter 7, Fear, we met a former policeman and a psychiatric nurse and some iron workers whose jobs involve real danger. In this chapter, we'll meet some others who deal with physical risk and danger every day. The second kind of risk is about, say, career or personal challenges that may not involve injury or death, but can end a career or a relationship, or on the other hand, bring personal success or respect from others. First, let's hear from those who take physical risks every day. Larry Lippert, who we met in Chapter 2, is an iron worker who has fallen, or as they say, gone in the hole, three times.
It's probably one of the most dangerous trades out there. There is certainly a mentality, you know, this is not for everybody. This trade is not for a lot of people. It takes a lot of nerve, man, to get up and do what we do. A lot of nerve. I've had a couple bad accidents. Personally, connect in 1997. I had a forklift hit a building, man, and it put me in the hole, 16 feet. That's the last time I went in the hole, and that was probably the third time in my career. I fell on Alcatraz when I was an apprentice.
Johnny Cooker is a crane operator who has seen death up close. He describes one job where 12 men were killed and fell to their deaths on a project in Las Vegas.
I've been around down the block from Vegas and City Center, and say only 12 people died on that job. Well, there was only 12 of them died on the job site. They didn't talk about the ones that died on the way out in the ambulance.
I asked Johnny what he liked most about his job. He stressed safety and communication. What's the biggest source of pride for you?
Best part of this work is seeing everybody go home every night. Having a great communication on the radios with the guys, enjoying seeing them smile when we're working hard and trying to put the pieces with the iron workers, the carpenters, plumbers, or whatever, just putting this thing together. The boss is down here pointing out, hey, we got to do this. It's all good, you know.
Renee, through photography, I got to meet and interview these iron workers. Shooting one day from the sidewalk, an iron worker came up to me and told me that the day before, they had to shut down the job because one of their crew, Renee, had his right femur crushed when a 2,000-pound beam came in hot and couldn't be controlled. So I asked this man to describe Renee's hard hat. At that point, I had about 1,500 images in my hard drive at home, and I searched through it and was able to find some excellent photos of Renee. I blew them up to 11 by 14. I matted them and then put them in a protective plastic holder. And the next day I took it down to the job site. This same guy came over and took the photos from me and said he'd take them over to Renee, who was in a hospital in the East Bay. A couple of days later, I was back shooting again, and this man came up to me and he said, when I took those photos to Renee, he looked at them and he began to cry. This touched me a lot. I believe that what Renee was feeling is a sense of power and grace that came through these photos, and it was probably something like he had never seen before. Here's how I described what happened next in a recent show.
You know, you think of these guys as macho and big, and they got the big hard hats and all the belts and stuff, but I think, like all of us, they want to be acknowledged for what they do. And people in the trade rarely get acknowledgement. And so what I think I was doing for Renee with this was giving him that acknowledgement that he didn't often get. Well, several weeks after that, I put on a reception for the iron workers in a little restaurant across the street from the building called Aria. There was about 80 people there, half iron workers and half friends. In fact, some of you here today were at that thing. It was an amazing party. I had, you know, wine and cheese and finger food. We even had a panel discussion where I had a couple of these guys get up and talk about what it's like to be an iron worker. One woman got up in the crowd and she said, "I'm a social worker, I work in the jail. And these men in prison can see where you are. And many of them think, when I get out, that's what I want to do. You're heroes to those prisoners." Well, halfway through the party, this uproar goes, "Whoa! What's going on?" Through the door comes Renee on crutches. He runs, comes right over, limps, hobbles over to me and gives me a big hug. I'd never met him. I believe that it may just be that photography is the shortest distance between two people. Renee was back on the job a month after that, and it had a happy ending.
Don Garlitz. I first interviewed Don Garlitz, the father of the sport of drag racing, who we met in Chapter 1, in 1973 for a class I was teaching at San Francisco State called The Psychology of Drag Racing. We were at the Fremont Drag Strip, where he was a contestant in the Winter Nationals, where all the top drivers competed. With one of my students, I asked Garlitz if we could interview him for my class. He graciously agreed. The three of us piled into his pickup truck. He told us many things, but what I remember most about that interview is that 3 years earlier, he had had a near-fatal accident. He was driving his 2,000-horsepower dragster. When the green light flashed, he stepped on the gas pedal with his right foot, and then tragedy struck. The torque from that engine was too much for the dragster's transmission, and it literally exploded. His legs straddled the transmission, and half of his right foot was blown off, and the car split in two. Garlitz was in the hospital for 6 weeks as his injuries were healing. He used the time wisely. He designed the world's first rear-engine dragster. With the engine, transmission, and differential now safely behind the driver, the sport became much safer. At first controversial, the rear-engine dragster took over the sport when, in addition to being safer, it started to win races. So these stories are about people who willingly take risks that could kill them. Now let's consider a category of risk that will not kill you, but might end a job, a marriage, or a career, or conversely, gain a job, a marriage, or a career. As Adele Sheely reminded us at the beginning of this chapter, you can never get to the big risks unless you start with small ones. As I developed through my later childhood and adulthood years, I knew none of this. But looking back and connecting the dots of my life, I do see a pattern of risks that reflects Sheely's model. In my life, there have been many small risks and several career and huge life-enhancing ones. Here are four of the small risks that stand out in memory. Hitchhiking by airplane. I took a small but real risk in 1968 when I hitchhiked across four states by airplane with pilots I'd never met and whose skills I did not know.
Another risk I took was sort of fun. In 1968, I had gone to Europe to be at a friend's wedding, and I'm coming back through New York. Now, I had heard about this thing where you can do drive a car thing. You know, you don't rent a car, but somebody has to have their car moved from one city to another. So I got in on that, and the city was Austin, Texas. That's where we're going to go. And I'd never been through the South, so I decided, 1968, long hair, and my license plate says New York. And I'm driving down through Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, and I'll tell you, it was really interesting because I would go through these small towns, and I'd look in the rearview mirror, and boom, there's a sheriff right behind me. Every move I made, the sheriff's right there. And I was the safest driver you have ever seen in this world. And it reminded me of when I used to smoke marijuana in college, and we'd go out for a burger, and I'm driving 10 miles an hour. No, officer, no, everything's fine. Well, anyway, so I finally got to Austin, Texas, and turned over the car. Then I had to get back to San Francisco. Now, I had read an article in Esquire magazine about a year earlier about how you can hitchhike by airplane. That sounds interesting. So I tried it, as they described it in the magazine, and what they said is, you go to small airports, you know, like our San Carlos airport, and you go to where pilots register their flight plan, and you have a little suitcase and you look nice and you go up to the pilots and you say, would you like a passenger? It worked fabulously well. I mean, to this day, I mean, if I didn't need a nice soft bed and my same pillow every night, I'd probably do it again. So my first ride was with a twin engine Beechcraft, beautiful plane, 8-seater, fabulous, and it got me all the way to Albuquerque. Then my second plane was this Bonanza. They're really nice, smaller planes, 4-seater. So I'm sitting in the back, it's a husband and wife, and the husband's flying away. And what I didn't know when I got in the plane is that this husband was a retired airlines pilot. And so he thought his job was to fly right into the storm so he could register back what was going on. And we're going like this, you know, and I'm thinking, Jesus, are we okay? And I'm looking at his wife who's sitting here, she's knitting. I said, okay, I guess if she's knitting, we're gonna be okay. But it was a great ride. And then I went, got a ride, and this was in an old beat up Piper Cub. And it was a 4-seater, and they had a one guy who was trying to get hours in for his license, to keep his license current, and a more senior pilot, and then a friend of theirs in the back, and I'm sitting in the fourth chair. And I'm thinking, well, I wonder if this thing's gonna take off. Are we gonna be okay? We start off down the runway, and finally we're airborne. And after about 5 minutes into this thing, we must have been at 1,000 feet or 1,500 feet, I hear this noise. My God, the pilot opens the door and pulls in a weather stripping, goddamn weather stripping, and off we go. So anyway, I took a commercial flight from LA back to San Francisco. But I thought that was really cool. You know, hitchhiking by airplane, I would recommend it.
Janis Joplin. In 1966, walking around in Golden Gate Park with a new camera, I came across Janis Joplin and Big Brother and the Holding Company performing from the back of a flatbed truck. It was early in her career and she was not well known, so there was only a small crowd, perhaps 200 people listening. I was blown away by her tear your guts out blues-infused music. I muscled my way up to the front of the crowd and took a few shots standing right below her on the bed of the truck. Looking around and realizing there was no security, I went around to the back of the truck and climbed up on the truck, holding on to the truck with one hand and aiming my camera with the other. I was able to shoot half a roll of black and white shots of Janis Joplin from literally 10 feet away. Many of those photos from that day are some of my favorites of all time. None of that would have happened if I had not taken the risk of climbing up on the back of the truck. Nobody told me to stop, and I got some of the best shots I ever took. Naked speaking. Soon after, I started my company, Power Speaking, where we train people to learn the skills of effective communication, I went to a workshop at Esalen on storytelling. It was taught by the famous storyteller Spalding Gray. Wanting to accept the challenge of maximum authenticity as a speaker, I gave a talk to the group of about 25, totally nude. People often say that when speaking to a group, they feel naked. I thought, as a leader in the field of public speaking training, I should try it myself. The class, totally lying, said, "Oh no, your being naked was not a distraction." Whatever, I have never regretted that little bit of risk-taking. For some reason since then, when I recommend students in power speaking to do the talk naked, there don't seem to be any takers. Still, I'm glad I did it. Jazz DJ. In the mid-1990s, our local radio station, KCSM, offered their audience an opportunity to become a guest DJ for 2 hours in exchange for a substantial donation to their fund drive. When I heard the invitation on the radio, my heart started pounding. I thought, oh my God, that would be so much fun. But do I know enough? Am I smart enough? Do I have the right music? I was flooded with all of the self-doubt that Adele Sheeley talks about. Somehow, though, I screwed up the courage, and I did 3 guest DJ programs for KCSM. As it turns out, I did a hell of a good job. I knew enough, and I had presence on the radio. It was a huge amount of fun. We got lots of phone calls, and the host of the show, Elisa Clancy, mockingly offered me a DJ job on the radio.
It's a morning cup of jazz. I'm Elisa Clancy. Our guest DJ is Rick Gilbert. 26 minutes past 9 o'clock on a Friday. And a lot of great stuff going on around here. And you're wonderful. I might have to offer you a job.
It's only because I'm being led down this road by a very talented lady.
Ba-dum-bum. Yeah, we're just kind of mutual admiration society this morning.
For those of you who've always wondered, Elisa Clancy has this flaming red hair. And marvelous talent.
I'm in radio, Rick. It's the anonymity.
I always wondered what you look like when I listen to you in my car in the morning.
Yeah, my guest is Rick Gilbert, who has been our guest DJ for the last 2 hours, and the phone calls have been very positive. They say, hire that guy. Hire that guy. Clancy, if you or Stan Dunn can't fill someday, you got to get this Rick Gilbert guy.
Yeah, I'm only going to be here if you'll be here too, Elisa. I had so much fun working with you.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. I'm Elisa Clancy. It's a morning cup of jazz. Your choices have been extravagantly tasty this morning. It's kind of like a big truffle.
Broadband.
Well, where it gets all of your tastes going, you know, everything tastes so good. I want to feel music down to my toes.
As we close out, I ended my last show with a quote from Carl Jung, the psychiatrist. I want to end with this as well, because I think it's very important. He said, the most important challenge of midlife is the question, what is my story? And as I look at my life, this music is a big part of my story. And I'll bet that's true for a lot of you out there listening. Mm-hmm. I want to take it out, as I did the first time, with a gospel. Last time I played the Staple Singers. This is a little bit more obscure. This is a gospel group called the Bells of Joy. They were out of Austin, Texas. Didn't get out too much away from Austin. But it's on an album called The Golden Age of Gospel Singing, and it's all a cappella gospel. I heard about it when Phil Elwood reviewed this particular song and said it was the most emotionally based songs he'd ever heard on record. And so long for now. Let's hear When Jesus Changed That Heart of Mine, the Bells of Joy.
Thanks a lot, Rick. Had a great time.
Well,
as I prepared to do my guest DJ slots on KCSM, I was riddled with fear and what I've come to identify as the imposter syndrome. You know, I'm faking it, I don't know enough, I don't have the right music, etc., etc. Well, when I listened to these clips, I realized it went pretty well. Lesson learned? Don't listen to those voices of failure. Oh, they'll always be there for sure, but we must push through them anyway. So these four stories are about risks, but risks of little consequence. Hitchhiking by plane, photographing Janice, nude speaking, and being a guest DJ. Several others along the way were of huge consequences, as it turns out. Public health. I risked my first job out of college with the United States Public Health Service at the Western Regional Meeting, where I challenged the leadership of the CDC from Atlanta, Georgia.
The thing where I took a risk with my job as a VD guy was we had a huge conference in LA at the Biltmore Hotel. 700 people from the Western states were there, and then the big bosses from CDC were there, and they were running this big thing. And one of the things on the agenda was to outreach to people, to get people to come into the VD department. And so they had this brochure that they wanted some feedback on. And the brochure was awful. I mean, it was all my pretty colors, and you know, you open it up, and there's this couple with their two kids sort of skipping off to the health department. And I'm thinking, you know, this looks like they're going to church or something. This isn't anything like the people I deal with in the VD clinic. So I'm sitting there. I've been with the organization for about a year and a half, and I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, because I talked to my friends, and everybody thought this little brochure was just nonsense. And so I thought, well, somebody's going to say something, right? Because, I mean, I'm a junior, wouldn't be me, so I'm waiting and waiting. So I'm sitting there with 700 people, my heart's pounding, and I said, well, I guess it's going to be me. So I stand up, and I have the brochure, I get the attention, 700 people, big ballroom, and I explain what I thought was wrong with this brochure. It didn't have any gay people on it, didn't have any people of color, it just seemed to me to be useless. And then I sat down and I thought, well, surely now other people are going to pop up because I'm the new guy and other people, I broke the log jam. So the meeting comes to an end And the big monkey muck from CDC comes off the stage and comes walking right up the aisle to me. And I'm thinking, my career in the public health department is over. Puts out his hand, he shakes hand, and he says, I want to congratulate you for having the courage to say what you thought was real about this. I think your feedback was very valuable. I'm wondering if you'd like to come to Atlanta and have a bigger job in the health department. Wow. Well, I didn't want to go to Atlanta. So we had a conversation, and then it was over.
What I love about this example is that it confirms Adele Sheeley's ideas that success depends on a person's ability to take risks. I took a huge risk by speaking up and got offered a promotion. Wow. As I look back across the years, I see another huge risk I took, which was the development of a new program at Power Speaking called Speaking Up, Surviving Executive Presentations. Coaching senior executives, I discovered that when employees have to speak to senior management, all the rules of presentations go out the window. The rules are so different, in fact, that if the speaker presents in the standard way, it can be seriously career-limiting. I started interviewing CEOs to find out what they demand from subordinates. The research started in 2001 and went on intensively for the next 10 years. We produced a DVD that was recommended by Forbes magazine. We created several classes about what middle management people need to do to be successful at the top. I also wrote a best-selling business book about what we discovered that has sold over 50,000 copies worldwide. While the research started slowly, it gained momentum over the years, finally costing our small company over $1 million. But our return on investment was very good. After 10 years of this program, and continuing today, Speaking Up represents about half of all of Power Speaking's revenue. This risk was not only good for Power Speaking, but also enhanced hundreds of thousands of business careers around the world. Looking back, the willingness to risk was what led to the success, just as Adele Sheeley had said. According to entrepreneur and CEO Audrey McLean, risk is easier if you have nothing to lose. In those early days, I didn't.
Now, along the way, where would you say were any sort of pitfalls or, you know, detractors or things you had to overcome in order to make this all work?
There are nothing but pitfalls. There were, you know, hey, get a scholarship. You're on your own financially. My general orientation was always that, A, nothing was going to be handed to you. You had to go get it yourself and figure it out yourself. And it's easy, I guess, to take risks when you have nothing to lose. You know, I didn't start with an inheritance and, you know, an Ivy League pedigree and a comfortable office where deciding to take an entrepreneurial risk was a risk. Everything I was doing was from scratch, so why not?
I'll end this chapter with a quote from Daniel Ellsberg. I asked him what advice he'd have for those wanting to make a difference, and he said, take a risk.
Investigative journalism can be truth-telling. Academic work, various investigations, truth-telling in general, which is generally risky in any bureaucracy, truth-telling, and yet it can be worth your life or your freedom. Don't do what I did if you know information that the country is going wrongly. Don't wait till the bombs are actually falling or until many thousands more have died before you consider risking your own freedom by putting out documents and putting out those truths, if you're in a position to do that. And many people are, not only in the government, but in corporations. The costs of telling those unwelcome truths tend to be very great. And therefore, it's not reasonable in general, it's not obligatory to tell those truths at whatever cost if the truths aren't that important. If it's, say, but often they are. There may be many lives at stake, and not only in the government.
As Daniel Ellsberg reminded us, taking risks can be dangerous, but sometimes it's absolutely necessary. Along the way, will need support. This is where mentors come in. In Chapter 14, we explore the mentor relationship and the power it can have to help us reach our goals.